Hi, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic. All right. I always start off my talks by saying, one, I have a home group. It is called the Way Out Group in Tannersville, Pennsylvania. Two, I have a sponsor. Her name is Melissa. And three, I have a sobriety date, which is September 6th, 1994. And it's really important that I start off my talk saying that this, me standing here really didn't have all that much to do with me. And it had a lot to do with the people that God put in my life and the power of God working through these people to enable me to reach a place which I like to call safe and protected, meaning that I don't have an obsession I don't have the obsessive mind of the alcoholic that tells me that alcohol is a good idea, and I don't put alcohol in my body, and therefore I don't set off that craving, and that's what I like to call safe and protected. My mind does not think about alcohol in the same way. And I like to start off my talk talking about that is because a lot of times I go into meetings and I hear about what alcohol did. You know, it took away my stuff. You know, I lost my husband, I lost my wife, I lost my kids, I lost my car, and we don't always get to hear about what AA did, what God has done for us. And those are the things that I like to talk about. I like to be somebody who talks about the beauty and the miracles that I see in Alcoholics Anonymous and what I get and why I'm still here after 15 years. And I want to thank, I really want to thank you all for making me feel so comfortable. Here's this thing. I absolutely hate speaking. I truly hate it. And God has got the greatest sense of humor that he keeps asking me to go to all these wonderful places with all these wonderful people that I really like. But I have to get up here and do that instead of, like, you know, messing with the chairs, you know, cutting up some vegetables in the kitchen. That's the stuff I like to do. I like to be behind the scenes. I like the anonymous part of the Alcoholics Anonymous. No. And God says, oh, yeah? Ha ha. You know, so, you know, being the Irish Catholic alcoholic that I am, I have this, like, this gift for, you know, BS, you know, that whole blarney thing. You know, so, you know, I get to use that wonderful gift that that I seem to have developed to, you know, to kind of further God's plans, you know, and to carry this message. And I feel I've been taught to respect and to feel the absolute weight of what it means to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been taught that it's a life and death errand. And these are things that we don't always, and maybe I've talked to a lot of you people, and your AA is rocking. I have to say that. You know, I love what I hear. I mean, I'm just sitting here going, you guys work the steps? Like, do you know I've been thrown out of meetings? I have. Do you know that, you know, people have come up to me after the meeting saying, how dare you bring a big book to a step meeting? And I'm like, instructions? You know, so I love it when I get to come to a place like this because basically if anybody listened to my tape and invited me, they know what I'm like. So obviously you kind of wanted to hear it. So I think we're kind of all on the same page, which is nice because sometimes, you know, sometimes a sneaky person on the committee sneaks me in thinking that I'm gonna wake everybody up, and then all of a sudden I get yelled at and I get pulled off in the corner and I have to spend 30 minutes discussing what alcoholism really is, and I get, you know, that's never fun. But if you want to do that, I'm certainly happy to spend some time explaining to you my beliefs, explaining to you my experience with the big book. I'm cool with that. That's what I'm here for. But what I wanted to do, and we're having dinner and we're talking about working with others. And I thought, my home group read this passage from the big book every Thursday night. And it's what we started our meeting with. And I thought, you know, I saw that create the fellowship that you crave. And I see this, you know, among them you make lifelong friends. And I thought, wow, this is the topic for tonight. This is what I felt that God wanted me to talk about. So I'm going to start with page 89. It says, practical experience will show that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion, which is, I don't like that word suggestion, but that's my whole, that's me. If I could rewrite the big book, I'd change that. Carry this message to other alcoholics. Exclamation point. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they're very ill. No duh. Life will take on new meaning to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Now, I don't know about you. There's a lot of promises in the big book. you know, everybody talks about the the nine-step promises are really big where I live. And I love to mess people up. I'm like, I want you to tell me the third-step promises. And they're like, there are promises after the third step? I'm like, all right, I'm going to explain this to you. After each group of the steps, there are promises. Bill's really smart. See, alcoholics, we're very much about results. In fact, I like to, and again, I rewrite my big book because I'm special. And I like to call them not promises, but results. Cause and effect. I do this, I get that. And that's why I explained it to the women I work with. That's why it was explained to me. Actually, it was do this, do what I tell you to do. And then I got to see what happened. It was like, whoa, that was really cool. Oh, that's in the book. But anyway, I'm a little bit, you know, I explain a little bit more to my sponsees. So, you know, where I live, you know, everybody talks about the nine-step promises, and they're great. I like them. I have them most of the time, except for when I have an amends that I don't want to make, and then I make that amends, and I get the promises back. It's really nice. but there are promises after every group of the steps. Every time that Bill asks us, or God asks us, the 12 steps, the program asks us to do something. It also tells us that we're going to get something. You know, so when we make that decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand him, meaning we write a 4-step, 5th step, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, that whole thing, you know, we get a result from that. You know, we go out and start knocking on some doors and making some amends. We get a result from that. You know, we start doing prayer and meditation in the morning. We get a result from that. And we start carrying this message to alcoholics. We get a result from that. And I have to tell you, the most beautiful spiritual experiences I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous were not mine. They were me watching another person wake up and shake off the shackles of alcoholism. And to be witness to that is the most beautiful thing I could ever, ever, ever experience. My own waking up, I wasn't even there for. I only found out later. You know, it was watching other people wake up that was the most beautiful thing for me. So I'll tell you a little bit about me, and then I'm going to rant more about God, because that's what I do. So I'm 33, and I started off that way because, you know, if you do kind of some math there, I got sober in 1994, and I don't look that old, right? You know, so I got sober at 18. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous since I was 13. I was unable to remain sober because I didn't know that there was a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought there was a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a lot of dances. I made a lot of coffee. I dated a lot of guys. I got into a lot of catfights in the parking lot, too. But I didn't do anything. I didn't even own a big book. My first higher power was a rock. My sponsor was like, you got to get a God. And I was like, I don't like God. God doesn't like me. We're not friends, and I don't want one. She's like, well, take this rock. This is your higher power. My mom threw it out when I was drinking. Like, I ended up relapsing, and I had, like, this apartment, this rat hole apartment, like, with no kitchen, you know, with, like, you know, I washed my dishes in the bathroom sink. I had, like, a mattress on the floor. And so when I got thrown out of that apartment, because apparently I wasn't, you know, I wasn't up to snuff with their standards. I had to stash all of my stuff in my parents' garage, and my parents decided to clean out the garage and threw out my higher power. Now, if that had remained my higher power, I don't know if I'd be standing here right now. Oh, my God. But here's the thing, is that when I picked up alcohol, and I've had a lot of conversations with people about this. They're like, would you become an alcoholic or are you an alcoholic? Is it genetic or not? You know, I really don't get into that controversy. In my experience, once I picked up alcohol for the first time and I felt something different, I was unable to control and enjoy my drinking from the very beginning. Because that's the deal about alcoholism. It's like, it's not that I can't put it down. It's that I can't enjoy putting it down. And if I'm enjoying it, I'm not controlling it. That's the deal. It's very simple and very clear. There's something physiologically wrong with me. I don't metabolize alcohol the same way normal people do. I have an older sister. And she's beautiful and she's successful. And she went to college, you know, before she was like 25. You know, she doesn't have a police record. She's never really, I don't think she has tickets. Like, she's, you know, she's a normal human being. She says things like, I want a nightcap. And I don't, that's not my experience, man. Nightcap? You know, she says things like, I want a glass of wine because I want to go to sleep. And I'm like, huh? And then she leaves it on the table half drank. I went on a cruise with my two older sisters. We went to Bermuda, which was fun. The three of us locked in a cabin for 7 days. Talk about a family afterward, right? Actually, it was really, really, really nice. But the thing is, it's like my sisters don't drink like I do. And they would say to me things like, well, wasn't that a phase? I'm like, no. And here's the thing is, like, I don't think about alcohol like normal people do either. And that's the thing. It's like, one drink? That doesn't make any sense to me. Because I absolutely know that, one, that's not going to happen. Two, why bother? If I was even going to do it, why bother? Because it's just, you know, not to be crude, but, you know, get you started, but it doesn't really finish you off. You know what I mean, Jelly Bean? So why even start it in the first place? So it's, if I'm not going to go full throttle, I'm not going to bother, because that's the way that I drink. And see, that's different than the average person. There's even people who, in Alcoholics Anonymous, who sometimes stumble in here who are something called a hard drinker, who look like me, who act like me, but when something changes in their life, they stop. See, but that's not my experience. I fought 6 Bloomfield police officers at my parents' living room when my parents called the cops on me, and I drank after that. I've been in 4-point restraints, and I drank. Actually, I was in 4-point restraints, faked a psychotic episode, got drugs, and then drank. Let me make that clear. Actually, to tell you the truth, I was in the 4-point restraints because I faked the psychotic episode to get drugs. But anyway, I promised I was not going to lie. So let's put that clearly. But the point is that I've been in 4-point restraints in a rubber room with my, you know, I've been in the places where they take your shoelaces away and your belt, and you have to sit there in your socks on the mattress and think about what you did. And I drank. I've had great things happen to me. I mean, I have wonderful parents. In fact, they're actually watching my 4 children right now, you know, in my beautiful home with my dog, you know. I mean, this is the life that I have. But I have, you know, I have a wonderful family. They're crazy, but they really, really love me, you know. But here's the thing is that I've had opportunities that I've absolutely been incapable of taking advantage of. And that's the thing, is we don't throw opportunities away. I mean, alcoholics, we're not stupid people. We know. We absolutely know what's going to happen when we drink. And the fact is, the pain that goes on inside of us makes us not care. We might say this time it'll be different. We might dress it up with some sort of excuse. But at our gut, when we know we're alcoholics, and we know what being an alcoholic is, and we pick up that drink again, it's because we don't care. I can't make myself care about the consequences of picking up a drink because the pain that's going on inside of me is so great, I can't care. And I don't have the power to put that information that I have in my head, knowing that once I pick up that drink, all that crap is going to happen. 6 Bloomfield police officers, you know, 4-point restraints, mattress on the ground, you know, living on the streets, things like that. Those things cannot dissuade me from picking up the drink. Because I'm an alcoholic. And that spiritual malady, that thing, and it's the thing I like to talk about most, because for me, this is the thing that cuts across everything. Everybody drank different. I mean, we all react. If you're an alcoholic, you react the same way that I do to alcohol, but you have a different relationship with it than than I do. You tell yourself different things. I mean, we all have themes, but, you know, maybe it's the funny uncle. That's why we drink. Maybe it's the ex-husband. Maybe it's the ex-wife. Maybe it's the dog. We all have our own excuses, our own little problems that we throw on the table to say, that's why I pick up that drink. Or to rationalize or excuse it or to just go for it. But the thing that cuts across and the thing that we all have in common, whether we're 50, whether we're 30, and whether we're 14, is that emptiness and loneliness that the alcoholic feels. How many times have you sat in a speaker meeting and you heard someone say, well, I got to kindergarten and I realized that I was different. Those kids knew something I didn't know. You know, that's because that thing, that spiritual malady, is that thing that I believe, or I've been taught, is the engine of our disease. Which is why God is the solution. Because if it was a matter of just changing something about my external life, whether it was getting a better boyfriend or a better husband or a better job, whether it was, you know, all those years I spent in therapy dealing with all of the traumas that happened to me in my childhood would have fixed me, wouldn't it? If my alcoholism was based in external circumstances. Because, yeah, you know, I might have this allergy thing. I'm allergic to cats. I don't really like to rub my face in them either. But I seem to do that with booze. A lot. You know. See, that's the thing. It's like, you know, smart people stay away from the things that they're allergic to. But the fact is that there's something inside of me that can't stay away from it, no matter how great the necessity or wish. On my own power, I'm incapable of doing those things. On my own power, I can know all of my triggers. You guys, has anybody here been to rehab and gotten your list of triggers? Jesus. Everything's a freaking trigger to me. I'm breathing. They looked at me. I'm the most self-centered, insecure bastard you've ever met. You'll look at me and I'm thinking, what are they thinking? I'm standing up here. You're all looking at me and I'm like, what are they thinking? Thank God I've done enough step work to be able to shut up and do my job. You know, but the idea here is this. Is the reason why God is the solution is because that's the only thing that treats that problem within us. So the idea here is, how do we get to God? What is it that I did? What is it that my sponsor did and my sponsor's sponsor did and her sponsor did? Well, actually, it was a guy, so. Anyway, one of the weird things about Alcoholics Anonymous where I live is there's not a lot of women who work the steps out of the big book. And I think it's a damn shame. In fact, most of the time I'm the speaker who gets invited in to yell at women to do step work so that the men stop sponsoring them because sometimes they slip on their banana peel and bad things happen. So they invite me in and they say, you know what, we got to get those women working the steps out of the big book so the men stop sleeping with their sponsees. I'm like, sure, I'll come in and take care of that. You know, and then I get to the car and I check, make sure like they didn't slash my tires, you know, things like that. But the thing is where I live, there's not a lot of women who work the big book. In fact, there's probably about 10 of us with double-digit sobriety. We sponsor most of the women in the state. It's sad but true. The fact is, if you throw a stone in New Jersey and hit a woman with a big book in her hand, I probably sponsor her sponsor. You know, and that's really sad. You think about this. I'm the paragon of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous in New Jersey. That's a really sad, sad state of affairs. I'm covered in tattoos. I was a juvenile delinquent. Every other word that comes out of my mouth is an F-bomb. I mean, the fact that I'm not cursing up here is, well, I did a little, but not that bad. It's amazing. My husband and I detox people on our couch. We have lodgers, which are usually our sponsees who are homeless. We run an impromptu rehab out of our living room. You know, and we're the paragon of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous because there's no one who has the time or the experience that we have. Because people don't work the steps where we live. People don't know where the program of recovery is. So we have to go out there and we have to fight with people and we have to stand up and be booed and be yelled at and be hated. In fact, where I used to live, I just moved to Pennsylvania 6 months ago. And where I used to live, if you said my name, you get two things. You get, I hate that woman. Or, for the men and the women, because I have no problem walking up in a parking lot saying to a guy who's sleeping with my sponsees, if you touch her again, I'm going to cut it off. We don't arbiter anybody's sex conduct. I'm not judging you. I'm just telling you. Or you get, oh, my God, that little brat saved my life. You know, and that's not because of me. And that's the thing about this amazing program is that I am a little brat. I got sober at 18. I am a foul-mouthed hooligan. I have four kids. I graduated college 4 years ago. It took me a really long time to finish my education. You know, I am not, you know, I've had so many wonderful things that happened to me in recovery and so many gifts of sobriety. But because of this program and the experience that I've had with the 12 steps, I've been able to help people who have PhDs, man. I've been able to help people who can't get a day clean. I've been able to help psychiatrists and lawyers and doctors and, you know, and this is the beauty in it because it's not me. It's God working through me, and I'm just his puny little instrument. So I get this beautiful experience of helping these people. I mean, I loved sponsoring, you know, I sponsored this woman who was an addictions therapist who couldn't stay sober. That was fun. God bless her, you know. But I mean, these are the things that I'm talking about here, is that, you know, we get to rub elbows and we get to have this fellowship and we get to see people grow. And I get to meet people that I would never normally meet. You know, who here has watched the Sopranos? It's where I grew up. Literally, they filmed it in my town where I grew up. That was my childhood. I mean, that's what it looked like. You know, you know. So I mean, like, you know, a little blue collar kid from Bloomfield, New Jersey, you know, with an attitude, gets to come to a place like this and talk to you all. Gets to sit down across my kitchen table with another woman and share my experience with her and watch her light up and God work in her life. To see her be knit back together is the most beautiful thing. But I had to do something in order to get to that point. It's not like I just produced this beautiful spiritual experience. It came through pain and work. It came from doing the 12 steps and continuing with this process. It came from, you know, enlarging and enriching my spiritual life. It came from not sitting on my laurels. I mean, there's one thing, it's something that always bothers me about, maybe not here, but about Alcoholics Anonymous, are those of us who have some time, who have some experience, who are not in the trenches, who are not sponsoring newcomers, who are not out there doing what we need to be doing, who say, you know, I got some time, I have a spiritual experience, I go to my home group sometimes. But, you know, if there's something really good on TV, I might not make it. You know, American Idol is, you know, it's only one season. You know, who say, I'm really busy, you know what, I'll give that newcomer my number, but I hope she doesn't call, and then you let it go to voicemail, and then she doesn't call you back, right? You know, the fact is that we all need to be in the trenches, because that's where my spiritual growth continues. It doesn't mean that I've stopped doing, you know, I go through the steps from 1 through 12 at least once a year. You know, I go back and I look at my first step. I look at that craving. I look at that mental obsession. I look at the unmanageability on page 52. I look at the areas of my life that are unmanageable. I look at my personal relationships. I look at my emotional nature. I look at whether I'm prey to misery and depression. I look at all those things. I ask myself the question, is God everything or is God nothing? What is my choice to be? Now, I can live my life as if God is everything but money. And, you know, my husband, you know, because, you know, I'm not going to let spiritual principles be involved in that. And maybe some of my kids, but only when, you know, when I can't handle it, you know. Or I'm going to live my life as if God is involved in everything that I do, and I do the best that I can to apply these principles in all of my affairs. And when I fall short, I grab onto that grace and make it right. You know, and that's the big thing. Is that, am I willing to do that every day? Or am I going to give up when I'm comfortable? Because it's easy to do that when things are good. It's easy to do that when we have everything back and everything's sweet. It's a lot harder to do that when you're new and alcohol's still nipping you in the ass. But guess what? Alcohol nips us in the ass every day. You know what it is? Ego, pride, selfishness. The bottle doesn't come at me in the bottle anymore. It comes at me in a, psst. You know, you're really busy. You probably don't need to take that girl's phone number and fit her into your schedule. You work 50 hours a week, you have 4 kids, and you're in graduate school. You can't fit her in. Or, psst, you know what? You were right with that argument with your husband. Don't make amends for it. Just keep fighting about it, and eventually he'll give in. Or, you know, that's what ego... Or it says, you need more stuff. How about this? Why don't we take our money and spend it selfishly on things that make me look good so you people think I'm good? Instead of paying my bills, you know, taking care of my children, you know, those sorts of things. You know, that's how alcohol talks to me today. It talks to me in the guise of my spiritual malady. And the thing is that we don't always realize it. We don't recognize it as being alcohol. We say it's just normal stuff. And I'm not saying that I don't ever screw up, because I do. I really do. My husband's laughing because he totally knows it's true. But the thing is that I have all these tools that God has given me to allow me to rectify to the best of my ability the mistakes that I make in my life and do something better. I mean, the biggest question, think about it. If you look at the sex inventory, you look at the fear inventory, you look at the harms done inventory, what's the biggest question? What should I have done instead? What could I do differently? So do you think maybe Bill wants us to think about what we should do instead of focusing always on, well, you know, I screwed up, I'm a piece of crap, and I'm no good anyway, so I should just keep doing stupid ass shit. Or maybe Bill wants us to say, you know, I got to make amends, I got to take responsibility, but what should I do differently next time so when I'm faced with these circumstances that I can go to God and say, God, please help me to do X, Y, and Z. Give me the grace and power to handle whatever situation this is like a sober woman. Oh my God. Maybe that's why we had to write that stuff on that piece of paper? Possibly? You know. So I take a look at those things. I take a look at my third step. You know? Am I really turning my life and my will over the care and direction of God as I don't understand him? Because I really try not to do that anymore. That's just me. And my will is my thoughts and my life are my actions. And the question is, and here's the thing, and that's the, you know how you know you're doing that? You know, if you've been through the work, you're living in 10, 11, and 12. That's how you know you've done your third step. You want to know how to do the seventh step? 10, 11, and 12. Oh my God. Do you ever wonder why the seventh step is only one paragraph and the sixth step is only one paragraph? Bill is a redundant writer. I mean, how many times did he describe, you know, the type of thinking preceding a drink? How many times did he tell us alcoholism wasn't curable? The only thing we have is absolute abstinence. How many times did he talk about the craving? He's redundant as all get out. And then he has two paragraphs on 6 and 7. You know what? You know why? You know what? Work 6 and 7? 10, 11, and 12. And make those amends. I'll tell you what, nothing will so much as remove a character defect as knocking on the door of somebody you screwed over to make amends. Those character defects were wrenched out by the root man. Some of them grew back. But I had to make amends again. And I'll tell you what, keep making amends for the same stupid stuff over and over again. Oh my God. Judgment's not one of them, I swear. Yeah. You know, and so, you know, we do this fifth step. And the beautiful thing about the fifth step, and the thing that I love about it the most, is not only giving one. I love giving a fifth step. I mean, I love, you know, writing all that inventory, and it looks pretty, and I different colored ink, and I got my pens and my paper. And by the time I leave the fifth step, it's chicken scratch, and there's coffee all over it. My sponsors crossed stuff out and said, liar. You know. Rewrite that. You know. But the most beautiful thing about the fifth step is hearing one. I mean, somebody trusted me with the most intimate details of their lives. Now, yeah, okay, I've heard it 1,000 times before, and there's really nothing I haven't trust me when I tell you there's really nothing I haven't heard. You know, I've sponsored all kinds of people, men and women, and in between. There's nothing I haven't heard. You know, I mean, and so they come to me with their special stuff. See, here's the thing. There's nothing I haven't heard before. But when you come to me with your stuff, it's yours. That's private. Yeah, I might have heard that same resentment 1,000 times. But it's yours. And you're trusting me with that. I was the most untrustworthy person in the face of the earth. My sister had 3 deadbolts on her door. I used to put a 2x4 in her window so I wouldn't climb in her window, steal her money and her drugs, which were prescribed legally to her. Not to me. And this was my mother showered with her purse. It took me a long time to pay back the jewelry that I stole, the money that I stole from my parents and my family. My mother had me arrested in her living room for stealing from her. Literally. I got a police escort to my third to last rehab. Oh, they waited through intake. It was only when I got brought up on the floor did they leave. And then they used to see me on the street and say, hi, Carrie, you going to AA? No. That's why I said third to last rehab. Anyway, you know, I'm the most untrustworthy, lyingness, stealingness person you'll ever meet. And these women come to me with their deepest, darkest secrets, the things that pain them, the things that scare them, the things that they don't even know how they feel about it because they haven't felt anything in years because they've been killing it with booze. And they come to me and they share this stuff with me? Oh my God, one, are you insane? Two, what a privilege. First, I think, you know, I sit them down and I say, you know, you must be low bottom if you're coming to me. Because you're completely nuts to trust me. But if you're willing to trust me, we're good. And then I always get to laugh. Because, you know, you think about it, half the women I sponsor are, like, right out of jail, homeless. I mean, I don't get the one. I mean, I got a few that were, like, high bottom. But mostly the women who come to me are the women who are beaten into a state of reasonableness. You know. And then I beat a little bit more, and it works out really well. You know. And so these women share this stuff with me. And they trust my guidance. And they say, well, Carrie, how do I make amends for that? I say, well, you know, I had to make an amends just like that, and let's talk about that. Or they say, you know, or they stump me, which has happened, and I've had to make some phone calls and say, who made amends like that? Oh, I know. You know, and I'll get someone for them to talk to. You know, but they trust me. I mean, I think for me, the most beautiful part of the fifth step was the fact that I became trustworthy because I did it. Because the fact that I was willing by pain and by being beaten into a state of reasonableness by alcohol and alcoholism. It wasn't a virtue, man. It was out of necessity because I had it was explained to me that I had two options, to die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. Those were my options. I didn't like the first one. I didn't even really like the second one, but I figured I had a better chance of making it to 20 on the second one, so I took a shot. That was really it. I sat there and I said, because the first time I worked the steps was when I was about 19, almost 20. It was the first time I was introduced to the steps. And it was about a month before my 20th birthday or something like that. And I remember sitting there going, you know, I never thought I was going to make it to 20 or 21. And my husband had gotten involved with a bunch of big book thumpers. And he came home with this book and he was like, you got to do this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, you just want me to do this so I stop being mean, you know, which was true. And, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, and they explain this to me, that die an alcoholic death, live on a spiritual basis. And I'm like, all right, I almost died. I literally was dead for 2.5 minutes through a suicide attempt. My last run, my mother actually drove past me while I was doing bad things in bad places. And I'm 18 years old. She saw me, made eye contact, and drove on because she knew that if she pulled over her car, I would break her heart. Because she could not take one more second of watching me kill myself. She drove past her 18-year-old daughter. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I can't imagine the amount of courage it took for her to do that, to not get involved and let me hit bottom. And I thank her to this day, for that matter, because she didn't cushion it. Not at all. And the fact is that, I think about these things, and I say, you know, I just totally lost my train of thought. Honestly, I just did. Anyway, so I talking about my mother driving past me. Yeah, that's my experience. So, you know, alcohol beat me into that state of reasonableness. So that when somebody said to me, we have a solution for this problem that you have, but it's going to require you to do everything you don't want to do, and it's going to scare the living crap out of you, but if you do it, you'll probably live. I was willing to take that shot. I was willing to gamble on it. I gambled on alcohol for so long. I gambled on all the other things that I used, all the human powers I used to fix my alcoholism. Why not gamble on something that is actually constructive? Holy crap. And I did. And I got this experience. And I did all these things that I'm talking about. And it wasn't me who did it. It was the power from within. Once you have that second of willingness, once that little switch is flipped, it's almost like it takes on a life of its own. I mean, it wasn't like I didn't fight or didn't argue with my sponsor. My sponsees don't argue with me. But it's really just lip service because I know I'm going to do it. You know, because I know that my sponsor is going to say, all right, then go drink. Oh, all right, I'll do it. Die an alcoholic death. Good luck with that one. Let me how it works out. All right. Okay. I'll do it. And the same thing. Same thing that I do. You know, I was taught, and it was something that works. I don't suggest it all the time, But when for a tough nut, I've had them buy a bottle of booze, put it next to their big book, and ask themselves which is easier. Sometimes when we stare down the devil, and the devil is really our alcoholism, but the bottle's a symbol for that. When we stare that down, we look at that liquid, and it haunts us. It sits there, and it calls us, and we drool. I'm thinking about it, I'm drooling. It has that power. It's like that little bit of liquid has all that power over me. Holy crap, I need to do something. Some of them have drank it, and then they called me the next day and said, I'm willing to do something. But the fact is that it's alcohol that beats us into a state of reasonableness. And it's God that carries us through the rest of this process. You know? And so as I do this work and as this work began to happen to me, and really that's what happened, is I didn't do this work. I hate using the word I. I stand up here and I talk about myself and I hate it. This work happened to me. Something awakened within me that I had nothing to do with, because I'm a lying, cheating bastard who wants to drink. That's what I want to do. And I don't want any consequences. That's the caveat there. I want to drink without consequences, which means that I don't want you to mess with me about my drinking and give me what I want. And if I screw up, you really need to forgive me right away. Not make me feel bad. That's the state that I want. That's not a realistic state, obviously. You know? So this happened to me because that switch was flipped within me. And this process began. And that knowing that I needed to have this spiritual awakening and have a relationship with a higher power was imperative, to the point where I sought it in any way that I could. You know, and where I lived, there weren't women doing this. So men sponsored me. Men sponsored me for a long time until I could find a woman. I was 5 years sober, and I'd been working the steps for quite a few years before I was able to find a woman who actually did the steps out of the big book. And I was like, holy crap. She said no the first time I asked her to sponsor. I hunted that woman down. I stalked her. I'd find her in the parking lot and go, please, I promise I won't call you too much. Please, I won't be a pain. I'll do everything you say. You won't even have to spend more than 10 minutes with me. She gave in eventually. I think somebody drank is what happened. But, you know, and she was like, so somehow something got freed up, I could say. You know, and she was like, you know, all right, I have 15 sponsees. I can have a 16th. Think about this. This woman, who had a couple of years more than me, was sponsoring 16 women because there's no one out where I live to do that job. Yeah. You want to know how many I've sponsored over the years? You don't even want to know. It's got to be the upwards of 200 in the past, 13 years, considering that I spent the first 2 years being dry and miserable. You know, and you got to think about that. And those are the people who are actually willing to do the work. Not the people who just took my phone number and then didn't call me. Those are people that I sat down and cracked the book with. My husband has done the same. We've run a house meeting out of our house for years. You know, we just moved, so we actually stopped it because we live in the middle of nowhere and people have to find us. But for years, I mean, to the point where our house meeting, people would actually leave our house meeting and start a meeting, local meeting, with the same name. It was with the last house on the block. We stole that from a friend of ours. He used to talk about, you know, AA being the last house on the block and God being the last house on the block. You know, so we ripped it off because we're good like that. We called it our house meeting, and it was the last house on the block. Now we live on the last house on the block. We don't have a house meeting. How ironic is that? So, you know, and people would come to our meeting. We'd sponsor them. They'd go through the steps. They'd have a spiritual experience, and they would go out and start a meeting called Last House on the Block. In fact, there's still a meeting in Morristown, New Jersey, called the Last House on the Block, which is really funny. And it was started by one of my husband's sponsees, and then now it's continued by one of his friends, and who is a sometimes sponsee. Long story. Who is engaged to my old sponsee. So, like, this is the way that this stuff works. You know, we have this fellowship in this family that create the fellowship you crave. Watching people grow up, watching people have a spiritual experience, being involved in that, rolling up my sleeves, and being a part of that is the most beautiful thing. And this is where I found God. Because I was a very angry, hurt little brat when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was unwilling to consider that God wanted anything but pain for me, because that's what I experienced for the first 18 years of my life. And I blamed God for that. I had a lot of things that happened to me. You know, I was like, I must have been like 4 months sober, and I was watching like Sally Jesse Raphael. You remember that show, Sally Jesse? It was like Jerry Springer Light. And like there was like this girl on there, she was like, alcoholic addict, teenage, pregnant, which I was pregnant at the time at like 19. 18, actually. I had my daughter a month after my 19th birthday. So, you know, pregnant, you know, abused child, you know, molested. And I'm sitting there going, I got that one. I got that one. I got that one. Oh, crap. I qualify to be on the show. Holy, oh. You know, I mean, so I got a list. I got a list of things that I could, if I talk to a civilian, a non-alcoholic, a non-spiritual, big book working alcoholic, you know, if I talk to like one of those people, either somebody on the street or somebody who's in the fellowship, and I told them my sad, sad story of the poor little Carrie, who was thrown downstairs and beaten and raped and molested, they'd be like, that's why you drank, honey. Those terrible people did all those things to you. You should write it. You should write about that in your journal. And, you know, maybe you need to take care of your inner child and you need to take care of you. This is a selfish program, Carrie. And people hurt you real bad and you should treat yourself well. My sponsor said, I don't give a crap. Write inventory on it. Get over it. Heal. She didn't care about my feelings. She didn't care. She was like, look. One of the things that she said, and I loved it, she said to me, she said, you know, not for nothing, Kara. I've seen people burnt with cigarettes and beaten with wires who didn't do half the stupid shit you did. Just saying. I said, good point. But here's the beauty, and this is what Alcoholics Anonymous does. Yeah, all that stuff happened. I mean, yeah, I went to therapy. I did. Therapy's a beautiful thing. It works really well with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not instead of. Just saying. And I did, you know, we go, you know what? If I have a toothache, I go to a dentist. If I'm crazy, I go to a shrink. That's the way it works. It doesn't make me not an alcoholic. It doesn't mean that I don't have to work the program. It means I have to do that stuff end. And the program allows me to take advantage of those things because I'm not so crazy and caught up in my alcoholism that I can actually heal. Oh, my God. You know, and I did some spiritual work with that. I did some amends. And again, this wasn't of my own doing. This was, you know, just like my sponsor likes to do. And what I do with my sponsees is kind of like pointing a load of goodness. Somebody say, die an alcoholic death, live on a spiritual basis. What you going to do, honey? Take the bait in your teeth, go and do it, or good luck to you. Because if you're not willing to do this, and if you're not scared enough, and if what you have experienced up until this point hasn't taught you that God has your back, there's nothing I can do for you. And the fact is that everything that I've experienced up until this point has taught me that God has absolutely had my back. That he has never abandoned me. I simply could not understand his plan because I'm a limited human being. I cannot see beyond the tip of my nose. And I always tried to define that plan. I tried to control that plan. And I tried to figure it out because I wanted to be God. That was the bottom line. And the fact is if I get out of his way and I shut my... I don't even like to use him, by the way. I usually use her just to mess with people. But I get out of her way and shut up. It's amazing what happens. You know. So one of the things that I found to be difficult, but I found to be one of the most beautiful experiences I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous was the amends process. How many times have you gone to a convention and heard people talk about amends? Let's talk about amends. That's something, it's not a big topic. But I'll tell you what, there is nothing that cleaned my clock like making amends. Nothing that crushed my ego and taught me humility and also taught me how to stand tall. You know, it says it in the big book. It says that we don't crawl before anyone, that we're children of God. We're not servile or scraping. And in fact, it says that in the session that talk about the amends. I wonder why Bill put that there. Maybe because he wants us to realize that although we've done incredibly insane, stupid stuff, that at our hearts, we're not bad people. And that given a spiritual solution and the opportunity to fix the harms that we've caused, that most of us will do that if we're taught properly. And if we've done what we need to do to get up to that point, to have some of the fear removed, to be able to trust God enough to be able to go knock on that door. And I'll tell you what, the most important and silly amends I've ever made And it was the most freeing amends. I mean, I made amends to my parents. It was crying. It was wonderful and healing and great. You know, I made amends. You know, I've had amends where people have told me they hoped I died. I've had people who told me, I don't want your amends. I've had, you know, I've had all kinds of amends. My favorite amends was when I used to shoplift a whole lot. A whole lot. And my sponsor really, truly believed in paying back the money. It wasn't my money, apparently, and those weren't my things. Really. And I was like, well, it's a big corporation. You know, they factor that into their costs. I had a mathematical formula. I researched it. You know, and I was like, so this is why I don't have to pay back that money, because I've already paid it with everything else I bought. She didn't buy it. Did not buy it. So I had to go back. I had to pay back the money to the stupid little stores around my neighborhood that I stole from. And what was funny about it was I had actually moved back to my hometown at this point. So these were stores I frequented. And I had to go back with my money in hand and go up to the manager and say, hi, my name is Carrie. I'm an alcoholic, and I will die an alcoholic death if I don't come and make amends to you. What can I do to set this right? Here's your money. This is what I think I owe you. What do I really owe you? This is what I stole. And I tell you what, I walked out of that store, and I was like, I can make any amends on the face of the earth. I was like the most horrible, fumbling teenage yuckness could walk up to me right now. Like the guy I threw up in the closet when we were like supposed to be making out, and I threw up all over him after drinking Everclear. And I drank again after that. So he said, that's a real alcoholic, man. You know, throw up and then pass out in the vomit. Lay there for a couple hours while your friends party around you. It's really funny. Anyway, that kid could have showed up at that moment and I would have been willing to make that amends, which I did try to find him, by the way, just so you know. Throwing up on somebody is a harm in that position. Trust me. So the thing is that I knew at that moment that I could, that God had my back, and that any amends that needed to be made could be made. And thus far, as far as I'm aware, and I say as far as I'm aware because I'm a dumbass, and sometimes I hurt people and don't even know it, and then I write the inventory later and find out I did. But as far as I'm aware, I'm clear and caught up, and I don't owe any direct amends. There's still restitution I'm making. I'm going to be paying that stuff back for a long time. But any direct amends, any first approaches, they're done. You know, and probably in some couple months when I write my new inventory, I'll have some more. That's the way this works. You know, so I get the spiritual experience. I get to know that God has my back and that I will not fail, that I will not fall, and that people can tell me to go eat shit and die, and that I will be okay. I grew a thick skin. God gave that to me. God did that for me. God removed my obsession with what you think of me. I mean, I still have it, kind of, but I can ignore it. God gave me the ability to say, you know, that's really not important right now. That wasn't my own doing. That was the experience that I had through working these 12 steps, which is why I can walk into a room and say the things that I say, or sponsor the women the way I sponsor them, and say, well, go drink and die. Good luck with that. And not worry about getting cold cocked. I mean, it's come close, trust me. I've never been punched yet. But I saw one girl, she really, Adam knows what I'm talking about. She pulled her fist back, and you know, it's like, and then she thought twice about it and said, well, if I punch this lady, if I drink again, she won't help me. And the truth is I would. That's the other thing that I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous, was that we don't close the doors on people and we don't give up on them. Now, I'm not going to assist you on your bottom. I'm not going to go there with you. But I'll be here when you're done. You know, I've had many of people steal engagement rings, money, things, you know, and I've also been willing to help them when they wanted it. Not because I'm a saint, because I'm not, but because that's my job. You know, the big book says that our mattresses are going to get burnt, that our furniture is going to get smashed, that keys will be pulled out of our pianos. I don't own one. I used to. And I'm sure if I owned one again, somebody would do that to me. But the fact is that they weren't doing it to me. They were doing it near me. And this is the other thing that I learned through having this experience and having God in my life and believing in everything that this book talks about. There's not a thing in here, with the exception of what Bill said, he didn't have any affairs. That I don't believe. But everything else I do. Oh, and the whole the wives written by Bill. That looks to two. Two things in the book I don't believe. Everything else I'm on board with. Just saying. I believe so fully in this book and in my experience with this book. And so, you know what? If someone pulled the keys on my piano, if they wanted to get sober and they had a willingness to do it, I'd be willing to go right back in there with them. Because my sponsors never gave up on me. God never gave up on me. I showed up to meetings drunk without my underwear, and they didn't make me leave. I swear to God I did. And they did not make me leave. They tolerated me no matter how obnoxious and what a brat I was. And I'll finish this up. I used to come to meetings, to open discussion meetings. I call them open disgusting meetings because I'm a bad person. I used to come to open discussion meetings, and I would, make stuff up just to, see if people would believe me. I'd be like, yeah, you know, I saw someone killed on the way here. I was 16. I didn't take it all that seriously, and I just figured, let's see if these people actually believe this. And they did, which I felt. I since made amends, by the way. I did. I went back to that group and made amends. But anyway, the fact is that, you know, I did things like that. And they had to know I was full of crap after, the third time I showed up with the same story. But they didn't tell me to get out. They didn't even tell me to shut up. They did tell me to read the big book, which I didn't do, which is probably why I kept lying. But the fact is they didn't tell me to get out. And they told me to read the stories in the big book. Let me clarify that. But still, maybe if I had read the stories, I might have stumbled across the first 164. But the fact is that Alcoholics Anonymous has always, always kept their doors open to me. And they've never turned me away. And I firmly believe in not doing that to other alcoholics, no matter what. You know, and so when I'm talking about all this stuff and I'm talking about what I do in my life and what my life looks like and what I've gotten and what I've experienced, all of this was because of this higher power that I had nothing to do with, that I didn't even sign on for, that worked through me despite my stupidity and continues to do so. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. And I want to thank you so much for having me. Thank you.